next matter on our calendar is Dunn versus Dunn. It should say Graf Dunn versus Dunn. Attorney's approach. Each party will have 15 minutes for argument. The appellant will have additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. We do ask that counsel identify themselves before they begin their presentation. Mr. Perry, you may begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and if it please the court, I'm Shane Perry. I'm here for the appellant, Kurt Doon. Your Honors, this case really involves a finding of fact by the trial court that the respondent, the claimant for spousal maintenance, did not submit a reasonable budget for her living expenses, for her reasonable living expenses, and that she also failed to substantiate her claim for reasonable living expenses. By contrast, and I should note, that wasn't appealed, that finding, or those findings. By contrast, the court found that Mr. Doon, the appellant, did submit a reasonable budget, and that the amount the trial court ordered Mr. Doon to pay exceeded the amount of his reasonable budget. It violates the general principles under Minnesota statutes governing spousal maintenance. One of the key factors, one of the essential factors courts are to take into account is Mr. Doon's ability to pay, meet his reasonable needs, and still have money left over to contribute. That the trial court did not do. Instead, in this case, what the trial court has done is allowed an order for spousal maintenance in the face of the statute, and most importantly, where the trial court acknowledged the respondent, despite multiple opportunities, over five opportunities, failed to establish what her reasonable need was.
The district court did credit some for expenses.
She did. That's correct.
$1,300 or so in rent?
No, that it didn't do. What it said as to rent was initially in an earlier order that $1,650 was the rent she was paying. When the trial court learned that that rent was being, supposed rent was being paid to her father, to the respondent's father, in the final judgment, the trial court said, there's no proof that she needs to pay $1,650 or that she is paying
$1,650. Right, but the district court essentially imputed $1,350 or something as rent.
Well, what the trial court said is actually it would be reasonable based on what the appellant submitted that she could incur $1,350.
Right.
But, Your Honor, she wasn't. The finding was that she wasn't needing to pay rent, that she wasn't necessarily paying the rent, that $1,350 is pure speculation. It's violative of the notion in Raskas versus Raskas, a case where the Court of Appeals said a litigant can't say, hey, I may need to get a house in the future. This is how much that cost may be. That was pure speculation on what might occur. The reality is there is no finding that by the trial court that the respondent was paying $1,350 a month, or even that that was the amount she would necessarily incur. Rather, it was just, it would be a reasonable amount. It would be a reasonable amount. It's pure speculation.
Respondent's brief helpfully provides excerpts from the transcript of the hearing or the trial, and it seems like you suggested to the district court that district court use your client's budget as a standard or as a benchmark and so on. I mean, doesn't that procedural history kind of, I mean, doesn't, the way that, I mean, that's essentially what the district court did, is take up your suggestion. Doesn't that really foreclose much of your argument?
No, for two reasons. First, the trial court didn't do that. What the trial court
Well, I think there's a lot of similarity between what the district court wrote in the order and what you said in the transcript.
Well, what the trial court ultimately did, if you look closely at the findings of fact, was determine that there was $211 in medical expenses, $300 would be a reasonable amount for groceries, and that was it. That's all she actually found.
Well, in the medical prescriptions as well. The district court at least implicitly pointed out that the respondent would need to pay, has expenses that your client doesn't have, and including those medical uncovered medical expenses.
I want to answer your question, but I don't want to forget Judge Johnson.
I'm sorry, I thought
I'll go to you first, Judge Ross.
Sorry, I didn't mean to take you off of the track.
That's okay.
You were done answering.
Those expenses, those medical expenses are completely irrelevant after Mr. Dunn's severance was terminated. COBRA terminated with severance. The expenses that Ms. Dunn had under her insurance policy when Mr. Dunn was working for the in the ATM industry completely changed. Instead, what we now have is $211 a month coming out of the federal employment retirement system to cover her medical expenses, and there is no documentation, which is one of the reasons I think that the court found that there was no substantiation for most of the expenses. There's only $211 in medical expense insurance. How broad that is, what it covers, there's no finding of fact on that at all. But Judge Johnson, I apologize. I kind of forgot your question, but I wanted to answer it. I know it was important. Oh, procedurally, did I create the situation for the judge to apply my procedure? The answer is no. In our submission, in response, I think it was on October 3rd, and Mr. Dunn's memorandum in response, we specifically said, this is not the standard. We were frustrated at this point because we had a judge who was looking at all these expenses and a respondent who didn't submit reasonable expenses or substantiation for it. And I said, even if you look at what Mr. Dunn has as a paradigm, and then you subtract out those expenses that Ms. Dunn wouldn't have, like she's not going to pay spousal maintenance, she lived in a duplex, she didn't have property taxes, those kind of things. If you looked at it like that, you still wouldn't get to the amount of spousal maintenance.
I have to say, I didn't read the excerpt that way. It seemed to me that the excerpt was not a judge, even if you followed this approach, we still would prevail. I read the excerpt, and maybe you can tell, maybe I read it wrong or it was taken out of context. I read the, and maybe you can put it into better context, I read the excerpt as offering the district court a different way, whether it's usually appropriate or not, a different way the district court might come to a determination as to the respondent's reasonable expenses.
You would have to go to the October 3rd, 2017 Dunn's response to the submission to see where I specifically said, this is not the law. You can't do this, Judge, before the judge's order. The burden is on the respondent to establish what is the amount of the reasonable need, and does Mr. Dunn have sufficient income to meet his reasonable needs and still contribute to that? We don't ever get to a point where Ms. Dunn, Ms. Graff now, the respondent, established what her reasonable need was. That is purely speculative. We don't know what that amount is. And spousal maintenance is dependent on it. If this case were allowed to stand, Your Honors, there is no standard. It actually structurally alters the spousal maintenance statute and the approach that trial courts would use, because it no longer is a burden of proof on the respondent. It would not, or on the claimant. It would be a meaningless burden of proof. She had opportunities before trial. She had at least five opportunities to produce evidence showing what her reasonable need was. And the trial court, if you look carefully throughout what she did, never says what that amount is based on specific amounts. The trial court comes up with a number, but doesn't say where it comes from. And there's no record evidence to get to that number.
So in, again, in the respondent's brief at page 10, there's a list of numerous trial exhibits that respondent's counsel, that appear to relate directly to her living expenses.
Yes, and my computer doesn't come up here, but I can tell you, just as an example, and I'm glad that you raised that, Judge Johnson, if you look at exhibits 12 and 13, it's entitled housing expenses, I believe. When you actually go to that exhibit, exhibit 12 is a list from the MLS, from the Multiple Listing Service, of homes for sale. And exhibit 13 is Wells Fargo's examples of what the mortgage would cost at a certain house value, a principal.
Among these exhibits are credit card statements, checking account summaries, checkbooks, and so on. Those seem to be, did those exhibits not include line items that are relevant to her reasonable monthly expenses?
They do not, for two main reasons. First, all of those expenses, the credit cards, the insurance, for instance, on the cars was from November to 2015 to, I think, 6 months later. That was for three cars, one of the children's, both of theirs, while they lived in Edina, in a different zip code. The credit card expenses, this was when Mr. Dune was earning in the ATM industry over $200,000 a year. He lost that job when the company, I forget what the technical term is, when they move to another country and incorporate there, that's when he lost his job and got the severance package. 6 months later, he was no longer earning anything. He was collecting unemployment. And the judge recognized that even during the course of the marriage when both parties were working, their lifestyle exceeded what their standard, what their income could support. It was unsustainable. And she said, certainly now, after the ATM business is gone, and Mr. Dune is now earning less than half of what he was earning in the ATM industry, it would be unfair to use the standard of living to determine that. So all of those credit card expenses, all of the expenses in general at the trial, that was before Mr. Dune lost his job. And that's why the judge said in her order, we're going to have a review hearing on September 13th, 2017. 10 days before, I expect you to submit any evidence that you're going to submit, any memorandum. And in the transcript of that hearing, it starts out where the judge says, I am reassessing maintenance in light of the changed circumstances. No documentation other than the questionable lease for $1,650 was raised, which the judge determined was incredible.
I think part of your argument, I'm switching now, if that's okay. Part of your argument is also, even if we take as given the district court's findings about expenses and income, you take issue with the district court's manner of fixing the amount of spousal maintenance by, providing that both parties will have an equal monthly deficit. So, what case law is there that, what's the best case law you have that says that was error?
I'd have to go to my brief, and my computer didn't come up, but the general idea in Nardini and Curtis that the respondent, the claimant, has the burden of proving what is the amount of reasonable need. Reasonable need is the touchstone.
But I'm skipping past that, I think. I mean, if we, once we've identified that each party, without maintenance, each party would have a surplus or a deficit of X and Y, the district court then awarded spousal maintenance to put them in the same position, basically.
I think the Kempf decision, which cites the cases from 1971, really makes it clear in just sort of black and white lettering, black letter law, that this isn't a profit-sharing plan. And when you equalize income, that's essentially what you're doing. It is a profit-sharing plan.
Well, here there wasn't... Okay. I think that... Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. I see that you're troubled by it. The notion that because neither party can meet their reasonable needs, setting aside whether somebody could prove reasonable need or did prove reasonable need, if you have a situation where the parties show that they can't both meet their reasonable need, there is no case law that I have found that says you can go ahead and allocate and and level, equalize their incomes.
And is there a case law that says the district court may not do that?
Yes. That's the profit sharing.
Kampf case.
Which is
it? Was that a case where, was there a deficit in that case, or was that more about profit, where there's surplus? Like, instead of profit, we could insert the word surplus sharing, but in this case, there is no surplus. It's sort of, it was not sharing the profit. I think the district court in this case described it as sharing the shortfall.
Right.
Is there any case that says the sharing the shortfall approach is an abuse of discretion?
I haven't found cases that specifically say it's an abuse of discretion, and I've seen cases on the other side saying, but they're unreported, that courts have done this sharing the pain, in essence. But I don't see where it was challenged. I don't see where we have a case directly on point.
In other words, it's just not, it's a case of first impression.
I don't think it's a first impression. I think that the Minnesota Supreme Court's cases dictate the outcome in this case, where the courts have specifically held back to 1971 and predating the Kempf case. I can't remember. Mayer, I think, is one, M-A-I-E-R, where this notion is you don't get to share profits here. You have to look at what the statute says, and what the statute says is, to the extent somebody is able to contribute to spousal maintenance, that's the limit on it. And in fact, the Arundel case, the respondent doesn't quote the entire case, but it states that to the extent that a party is able to contribute to the spousal maintenance of the recipient party, it's capped to what they can meet, what reasonable needs they need to meet.
Okay, Mr. Perry, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is John R. Hill, H-I-L-L, with the Larkin Hoffman Law Firm. The standard of review here in this case on a spousal maintenance award is, did the lower court abuse its discretion, its great discretion, in awarding permanent spousal maintenance to Ms. Doon, now known as Ms. Graff? You've seen the torturous procedural history on this case, multiple days, multiple orders. And you start with the April 2017 order, where she awarded permanent spousal maintenance. And Judge Sigismund made incredibly detailed findings, single-spaced findings, page after page, that addressed my client's education, her employment, her physical disability, her ability to work, whether we should impute income to my client, her health, the length of the marriage, her age, and of course, the standard of living. That's what the statute says, the standard of living the parties enjoyed. And she determined in April 2017 that it is a permanent spousal maintenance case.
Can I just give you my big picture concern, and you can
sure
knock it out of the park if you can? I look at the case, correct me if I'm wrong about this impression. You've got the obligee who comes into court and is found by the district court did not provide support for her budget, and the budget was not credible or reasonable. She was willfully unemployed, and the burden was on her to show need. On the other side of the equation, you've got the obligor who arrived at court with a reasonably with a reasonable budget, substantially reasonable budget, supported by documents, and he sought and obtained the highest paying income that he could, and he didn't have the burden of proof. And the district court still found in favor of the obligee without actually defining what her expenses were, and then imposed this sort of income equalizer. Mm-hmm. So give me a sense of why my big picture concern is lacks merit.
Sure. Well, we provided my clients a detailed budget. I mean, if you go through the record, you'll find multiple budgets. The one-page summary where you go over your expenses, you'll find those. As Judge Johnson pointed out, the exhibits are voluminous.
Looking at the district court's findings, the district court found that your client's listed budget was unreasonable and unsubstantiated, and in some ways not credible, including her housing expense.
And the first piece of the answer is that this is the rub you have in these cases where we're trying to create two homes where there was one. The statute says look at the marital standard of living, which nobody can afford here. He can't afford it, she can't afford it, mm-hmm. but the statute says use the marital standard of living. And so it's difficult in these cases.
Well, it says use the marital standard to the extent it's equitable. And
correct.
It's, in this case, right. The district court said we can't do that.
You can't because there's not enough money to go around. And so what expenses is somebody supposed to give, their actual bare bones expenses or their marital standard of living expenses? So it's a rub in these
cases. Well, the actual expenses. In this case, the district court didn't find that she submitted a supported budget that right. is reasonable.
And so,
whether it's actual or not, if their budget's just not a reasonable one, and again, and not supported. So I
get that. And so the judge asked my client to provide more documentation. We did that. Mr. Dunes submitted an affidavit that's been referred to here where he went through each of my client's statements. And in the July 2018 order, the court said, despite her lack of documentation, the court rejects husband's suggestion that she has failed to prove that she has no reasonable expenses. Certainly his expenses are a guide, and the court has assumed many of them. And it's not unusual for people who've had a long-term marriage to kind of sort of have similar expenses. He might have higher housing expenses. She has higher medical expenses. But their entertainment, their clothing, their travel, their trips, their gifts, those are kind of sort of similar. You would expect that in a long-term marriage. And that's what the judge did.
If that's so, and here's another part where I'm troubled. So the district court reached the conclusion that it was going to credit your client with $1,300 or $1,350, I think, and the cost of the housing. And the district court credited mm-hmm. husband's housing expense that was substantially more, mm-hmm. Included taxes, a lot more. Why, if there's such a disparity in just that alone, would the district court begin with the baseline of each party being at whatever, $4,400 or whatever the amount mm-hmm. was, if it's clear that the most substantial category is much greater for husband than wife? Did the district court make adjustments that were...
Well, I think the court did make adjustments for her expenses. She put those in her findings. Mr. Dune commented on those in his submission. And she does have a lot of high medical expenses, which is really apparent from the record and the underlying documentation.
But can you address that point that I just made, that if, why would the district court, like you've said, that well, your expenses, you can assume that they're relatively the same, but we know from the district court's findings that at least the most significant expense is not the same.
Right. And for her expense, she said, I don't think it's credible that you have $1,600 for a rental expense.
Right.
So I'm making that $1,350. They had given some information to the court that this is a reasonable cost for a condo or an apartment in Eden Prairie. So she adopted that. She made findings regarding my clients.
No, I understand all that. My question, though, is you were making, I thought you made the point that, well, the district court can reasonably infer that the expenses are about the same for the two because they were married and have roughly right. the same sort of treating them both equally, right. but if the most significant element of the budget presented, the housing expense is so significantly greater for the husband okay. now mm-hmm. under current conditions mm-hmm. than the wife, why do you begin with that? Why doesn't that refute the presumption that you said the district court could reasonably operate under?
I don't think it does. I mean, she can recognize that some expenses are different. And some expenses are similar. And she recognized that he has higher housing, she has lower housing, she has greater medical, he has lower medical. And she can use some of his comments as a guide as to what her reasonable expenses might be on pets and travel and gas. I mean, she heard the credibility of everybody. And so I think she was able to do that. I don't think it's... Did the court abuse its discretion in coming up with a maintenance award where nobody gets enough money?
Is there any other case that you were able to find where this issue was ever presented, the sort of the basing an obligee's expenses on the obligor's expenses and also the other issue of equalizing the income? Were you able to find
it? On the first part, no.
Okay.
On the second part, I did cite an unpublished opinion, Hagen versus Hagen,
right,
where Judge Broughton, who used to be a family law attorney, and he's been on the bench for about 3 or 4 years, the Court of Appeals affirmed his decision to equalize cash flow in that case. And this is not an uncommon practice. This is not an uncommon practice in the district courts when you don't have enough money to go around and you give each party the same pot of money. And you say your budgets, if you read the transcripts here, the court would say, I would say, the budgets here don't matter. The budgets are irrelevant because whatever budget you find, nobody can meet. She can't meet her budget. He can't meet his budget.
That was the argument, that he can meet his budget.
Well, with no spousal maintenance.
Well, with some spousal maintenance, he could still meet his budget, but the district court dipped further into his budget.
Right. And in this case, he did not equalize cash flow. She equalized deficits, is what she did. And so I have found unpublished cases, and I cited those, Parker versus Parker, 1997 Westlaw 658938, 1997 is another case that was affirmed for an equalization of income.
Is this in your brief?
It is not.
Say it again, please. Parker?
Parker versus Parker, 1997, WL 658938, 1997. There, the trial court divided the shortfall and made the parties share the pain on an equal basis. Judge Swenson, who used to be a family court judge in Hennepin County, was famous for equalizing the pain, sharing the hardship.
But there are just no appellate cases.
No, there? Not published ones. Now, Seidel versus Seidel, well, that's unpublished. I apologize for that.
And which is the case in which you said Judge Broughton?
Judge Broughton, that's Hagen versus Hagen.
I see that cited. Okay, yeah. Thank you.
And that was earlier last year where he equalized cash flow. And so we don't think that my client, did the court abuse its discretion? And that's the question. Did the court abuse its discretion? And when you focus on that statement again, despite the lack of documentation, which if you looked at the binders and the exhibits, I mean, we went down to Costco invoices where my client was asked about the chicken sandwich she bought at Costco. That's how detailed this trial got.
And opposing counsel says that the detailed spending records relate to the prior period of affluence, kind of a temporary period of affluence.
Right.
I mean, did you have evidence that is later in time, which is, you know, more current?
Right. You'll find that in the later exhibits, because the initial exhibits, the chicken sandwich one, these are the marital standard of living. This is when the trial is beginning, which took 10 months to do, because that's the standard, the marital standard of living. Then Mr. Doon loses his job. My client's disabled. She's supposed to go to work. I mean, so we have all these moving pieces in this case. But you'll find in the later exhibits, she's submitting more of her actual expenses at that time. But again, the statute says marital standard of living. So did the court abuse its discretion? No.
So in other words, I guess my question is, did you have evidence that related to a relevant period of time, the later
yes.
period of time, which is more similar
right.
to the current situation? And your answer is yes?
Yes, and those would be exhibits further down in the books, further down in the numbers, because as this trial kept going along and along, we kept introducing more documents. Normally a trial like this should take 2 days, but given my client's disability, we could only do it at 3-4 hour blocks at a time. And then he lost his job. That affects everything. He comes back. We needed a review. But did the judge abuse its discretion? No. Because she looked at all the evidence. She took up Mr. Perry's suggestion. Look at Mr. Doon's comments to her budget. Look at his budget. And she came to a reasoned conclusion that my client was awarded permanent spousal maintenance, needs spousal maintenance, and I think she did a fair job.
Would it have been reasonable for the district court to limit spousal maintenance to ability to pay without encroaching on appellant's expenses, ability to meet his expenses, his reasonable budget?
No, because I think in a long-term marriage, simply because the obligor lacks income to pay all of his reasonable expenses, is not in and of itself a reason to deny my client an equitable.
So you would say that as a matter of law, the district court is required to apply a share of the pain
approach? Required, of course not.
Well, that's what I thought you were...
No, it's not required.
Well, that's why I was asking, could the district court, do you think, have reasonably reached the conclusion, supportable conclusion, that, well, we're not going to require spouse to...
Of course. I mean, could the court have reached that conclusion? Of course. Absolutely right. Would that have been its discretion?
Within its discretion. Right. My question was.
You'd have to read, in that case, you'd have to read the opinion and under the circumstances, but that's not what we have here. This judge here said, I'm going to equalize.
No, I'm just trying to get a sense of what your understanding of what our approach of the law should be and the district court's breadth of discretion in deciding whether to share the pain.
Spousal maintenance, broad discretion. And if that's what the judge in this case thinks is reasonable.
So you're saying the share of the pain approach is within the district court's discretion, and it's also within the district court's discretion not to share the pain.
Absolutely. Right. Under the facts, every case has different facts. You affirm Judge Broughton. He equalized cash flow. It's a similar concept. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. Mr. Perry, any rebuttal?
Judge Johnson, to answer your question about whether or not there were exhibits that were submitted after the trial, there was one exhibit that I think was submitted after the trial court issued its order, and that's the lease that was highly questionable, that didn't have an amount for $1,650 in it, that was for the father's, it was undisclosed, but for the father's owned premises. When it came to making the decision on September 13th, 2017, there were no new exhibits. Other than that, as far as I recall, all of the exhibits that were submitted during the trial came before the judge's decision, where the judge said, ultimately, in the judgment, it's not a credible budget. She didn't prove a reasonable amount. It's mostly unsubstantiated. Trying to equalize all of this ignores the first requirement set by the Minnesota Supreme Court for decades. There has to be reasonable need proven. Proven reasonable need. That has never been done. She has had more than five opportunities to do this. We have struggled to try to get that information.
I see this case as having two independent issues. The first having to do with whether she proved her reasonable expenses, the second being given certain expenses, the district court's actual award. You keep going back and forth, but which is okay, you can do that, just before that, we were talking, I think, about the second issue.
Yes, but I think you're right. The tension here in this case is she failed repeatedly to meet her burden of proof. And despite that, the judge went ahead and awarded spousal maintenance. And not only awarded it, but exceeded what the statute calls for, to award maintenance within somebody's ability to pay. The Curtis case, the Arundel case.
Well, but that's not a bright line boundary, is it? I think it's a factor to be considered, that both somebody's needs and somebody's ability to pay.
Yes, it's all within the context of the statutory factors. The court has discretion to go beyond that. But in this case, the very first thing, Mr. Hill was asked by the judge, and the judge made it clear, is the first step to determine what's the amount of reasonable need? The answer is yes. The case law establishes that.
Not to put you to the burden of choosing which of your children you love the most, but which of the two issues do you think is the strongest for the appellant? Your argument as to the district court's approach to expenses, or the argument as to the district court's approach to income? By income, I mean sharing the shortfall.
If I understand correctly, sharing the pain or sharing the expense, I think both of those arguments fall in the face of...
No, I understand that your argument is that both. Which one do you think is your stronger position under the law? What has the most case law support?
I think the most case law support is that you don't have a profit sharing, which would be sharing the income.
Well, I understand the theory behind the inappropriateness of sharing the surplus or sharing the profit. I don't know that you've tied all the knots showing that it's inequitable, inappropriate, and abuse of discretion not to share the shortfall. They seem to be different. To say that one spouse can't go and collect when the obligor happens to have a windfall, increases income, has more than enough to meet his or her needs, it seems to be different substantially from, wow, you don't have, neither party has enough, assuming the expense analysis is correct, neither party has enough to meet a even close to the marital standard of living, so you're both going to suffer somewhat.
So
they're different, aren't they?
They are different. And the equities, I think, where somebody can't meet their reasonable need may play more in a case where somebody is really trying to get a job as opposed to just disregarding the trial court over and over again and refusing to get a job and having income imputed to her. This is not a case where the people are living similar lives and doing similar things. And boy, the judge just really struggled with trying to figure out what's fair here. This is a woman who repeatedly came to court in high heels while claiming that she had imbalance problems. The judge commented on that in one of her orders. The judge commented on her refusal and her not being credible about not knowing she needed to come to court talking about what effort she made to get a job. This is a case where a man...
Well, the district court penalized her for that by imputing income. The district court covered that part of it by imputing income to her.
Yes. And she did it ultimately at the very end of the case in the judgment where she said, I'm imputing income because of her willful refusal to become employed in good faith. But ultimately, Your Honors, if this case is sent back, it sets a precedent that's going to be a mess in the trial courts. It's going to establish that you don't have a burden of proof if you're a claimant. You can go ahead and make 4, 5, 6 court appearances, opportunities to submit evidence, and not do it, and we'll share the pain anyways.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Breen.
Thank you.
Did you have a question?
That's okay.
Okay. The matter will be taken under advisement. Thank you both. Decision will be issued in 90 days.
Sorry. Thank you.